This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So what Coolbox has done is we've integrated for the first time in freezers, lithium batteries. So you actually don't know that you have lithium batteries in those freezers. So what happens is when you have power, you can connect them to the grid. And we don't have power, you can actually charge with solar panels.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we take a break from worrying about the election and look beyond these shores. First, we speak to Ayula Dominique, the CEO and co-founder of Coolbox, an innovative refrigeration solution for the large swaths of sub-Saharan Africa that don't have reliable access to electricity. We get an in-depth look at the company's technology, learn about the challenges they're facing, and discuss the relationship between Coolbox and the Clinton Global Initiative. Then we revisit part of our 2023 conversation with author Tim Killeen, who's chronicled efforts to curb deforestation in the Amazon.
And your bankers too. Let's get up and learn those rules. Weatherman and the crazy chief. One says sun and one says sea. AM and FM, the PM too.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Ayula Dominique. He is the CEO and co-founder of Coolbox. Ayula, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much, Alex, for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Why don't you explain to us what Coolbox is in if you can summarize what your product is all about, that would be great.
So I'll start with a bit of a context. So in sub-Saharan Africa, you have over 600 million people that lacks access to electricity and therefore lacks access to refrigeration. As compared to Europe and America, where you have 100% penetration in refrigeration, in sub-Saharan Africa, you'd be shocked to know that it's only 17%. I repeat, only 17% of the people have access to refrigeration.
We're talking permanent refrigeration, like you have a refrigerator running 24/7, right?
Correct. And you obviously, we know what that means in terms of food wastage. About a third of all food is wasted before it gets to market. And we're talking small restaurants, we're talking small bars. And these are things that normally we would take for granted in the West, but it's a real problem in Africa. So looking to solve this problem, myself and my co-founder, like 3 years ago, decided to found a company called the Coolbox. And the goal was to make refrigeration affordable and accessible to everyone that needs it. So using the sun and water, which is abundant in Africa, we created a solution that is able to generate refrigeration for up to 4 days, whether or not you have power, whether or not you have sunlight. And this we did by storing energy in the form of ice, as opposed to just storing energy in the form of batteries. But of course, looking at the peculiarity of the customers we serve, then the big question, I mean, of what good is the technology if no one can afford it? So what we did was we integrated in our units a pay-as-you-go technology, enabling individuals and small businesses to be able to pay as low as $10 to $15 every month to own a refrigerator. And today we've deployed in over 6,000 units across 26 countries in only 3 years. And we're still doing more, actually. So that's what we do, basically. I don't know if that is pretty clear, Alex.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's break down the technology a little bit more, if you can. How does it differ from a very well-insulated cooler? Cooler technology has really come quite a way. People who go to concerts or festivals can put ice in their cooler and it'll still be cold 3 or 4 days later.
Correct. That's a very good question. Actually, the concept was gotten from that same concept. Like, so what we have today is what we adopted from the concept of cooling in vaccines. So we just took them and adapted them for restoration. So the only basic difference here would be that beyond thick insulation, you have what we call phase change materials, which are in this ball process, we can call it ice, but it's not really ice, but it is liquid with that is able to retain temperatures for longer hours because they are water mixed with esters, and these are able to conserve temperatures for longer hours. So that, you would say, is the basic difference between the two, apart from the insulation, the fact that we actually use what we'll call phase change materials, basically.
And you mentioned the price is monthly, but what is the overall cost, and how do the most vulnerable populations get access to it? $10 to $15 a month may not sound a lot to somebody in the West, but it could be very expensive to somebody in sub-Saharan Africa. What is the overall cost of this unit?
Now, the average cost, thank you for that question, is around $1,000 to about $1,300. And this could be spread over over 3 years, sometimes over 4 years. So that's the average cost. And the average income is usually around $30 to $50 a month. Some $30 to $50 a day, depending on the size of the units, basically, yeah.
The income that it produces, you mean?
The income of the small, because we're focused on small businesses that require refrigeration for income generation. So we're talking about bars, small restaurants, and the average income daily is like $30 a day on the average, depending on the size. And if you multiply that by maybe 20, that's about $600 in a month for the active days, and they get to pay about, $15 to $20 to $30 per month for the refrigerator.
And how do they get delivery of the refrigerator? What's your distribution model, Ayula?
Great question. So we do work through partners, existing solar distributors in different countries. These are distributors that have distribution network, and they deal with the kind of customers we want to deal with. And that's how we've been working with them. So we have big players that are big in solar. They sell solar panels. They sell solar home systems as well. We leverage on their network to be able to reach our customers, basically.
And you mentioned the space age technology. Why don't you break that down a little bit more for us? What do you have in the units in terms of lithium ion batteries and solar panels? Explain how this all works, if you can.
So basically, today we have different customers, and these different customers have different needs. So some, like you rightly observed, just want to cool. These are like the beverage dealers. They don't want to get their bottles broken, so they just want to cool. And then you have customers that want to freeze. And these are customers that require longer cooling hours, like freezing, require longer freezing hours. So in that situation, they will need external lithium batteries. So for customers that want to cool, the ice batteries, which you rightly observed, is sufficient for them. But then when we're talking about respecting the cold chain, that means literally we have to have a lithium battery. So what Coolbox has done is we've integrated for the first time in freezers, lithium batteries. So you actually don't know that you have lithium batteries in those freezers. So what happens is when you have power, you can connect them to the grid. And when you don't have power, you can actually charge with the solar panels. And beyond that, we also have the ice batteries combined with the lithium batteries to give them optimum energy efficiency. Beyond that, we also have the PEGO technology, which enables us to understand the temperature in the refrigerator, understand the billing of the customer, understand when the customer opens or closes the freezers, the location of the freezers. This is extremely vital, particularly for after-sales services. So I don't know if that explains your question, or maybe I'm not answering your question precisely.
No, you did, but also it goes back to answering my initial question about how it differs from coolers. Like a cooler, you can't freeze, you can't produce ice, so that actually can perpetuate the cooling cycle for much longer, I imagine. If you're making ice, then it has a lot more use than just an ice box, a traditional, what a lot of refrigeration was in North America in 1900, let's say, right?
Sure.
So people would get big blocks of ice and put them in coolers, and that would suffice for back then. But producing that ice is a game changer.
Exactly.
But explain a little bit more how solar works in all of your technology, if you can, Ayula.
Awesome. So during the daytime, when you have the sun, energy from the sun, which is solar energy, ice is made in that compartment, which is the ice batteries. So that at night, when the sun is not available again, the energy stored in the ice keep the product cool for the next couple of days. So that's what solar does. So solar basically helps with the solar energy that is being collected, that is being converted to electrical energy to drive the compressors and also keep the refrigerators cool.
I've got a cold, cold feeling. It's just like ice around my heart. I've got a cold, cold feeling. It's just like ice around my heart. I know I'm gonna quit somebody every time that feeling starts.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to the CEO and co-founder of Coolbox, Ayula Dominic. So Ayula, if you can explain where you are as a business right now and your relationship with the Clinton Global Initiative, that would be helpful.
Awesome. So we currently are just closed the funding of around $5 million Series A in equity. It's part of a $21 million total funding round. And currently we are at the point of scaling. I think we've tested the product. We think we have a product market fit, and we're trying to scale at the moment. So with the Clinton Global Initiative, we've been invited to the program. I had about two speaking sessions on the product itself and the impact we're trying to create with our product. And this is my first time here, basically, and we hope that we'll be invited again next year.
And you're trying to do more than just be a cooler or a freezer for these populations that don't have electricity. You're trying to provide really a bridge to more modernization. Why don't you explain if you can?
So for us, basically, we provide the energy, and then the in an environment where energy is scarce, whenever they have it, they try to take advantage of it, even if it's to charge their phones, to light up their houses. As long as they have that energy, they are excited, and that's what we do. But beyond that, actually, what we've also seen is that with the data we're collecting, we're actually becoming a data hub for connection of customers, because now data is at the core of what we do. We have over 6,000 robots out there sending data every day. We know when they open their freezers, we know when they close their freezers, we know where the location of the freezer is, we know the temperature in these refrigerators. And we're talking about different people in the different value chains. So we're looking at smallholder farmers that are into livestock. Why not connect them with a frozen food seller who buys directly from them at the best price? And then we're talking about frozen food seller. Why not connect that frozen food seller to a consumer who wants to buy units? So because now we have everyone in that single platform, and we've got data. Appliance manufacturers, we're talking about LG, Samsung, why not connect them to customers that would like to get their appliances? So that's how we're seeing Coolbox. We're morphing from what we call just a typical appliance manufacturer to a data hub where we get to empower our customers. And that's what we're beginning to see. We've seen customers request best prices for livestock. We've seen appliance manufacturers coming to us to request for data. We've seen coaching manufacturers coming to request for data because they want to expand their services and they want to get the best services. So that's what we've been seeing, and that's basically the future of Coolbox, yeah.
And you're talking about customers requesting information, and how do you reach these customers and how do you gain awareness of your product in more remote areas?
Yeah, basically through word of mouth, radio does a huge amount of work. We do on-ground awareness programs where we go to different markets. But now another trend we're beginning to see that works really well is the internet. Because our customers are not necessarily in rural areas. They are customers in peri-urban areas that have challenges with electricity as well. So we're beginning to see a huge uptake with peri-urban uptakers, particularly in cities like Lagos, in cities like Kampala. I mean, these are cities that still have challenges with electricity.
So these are very densely populated cities that just don't have a very developed electrical grid.
Exactly. The population sometimes is way more than what the grid can afford, can accommodate, rather, and therefore there's a load shedding which has to be applied so as to ensure that people have power.
And you mentioned how this keeps refrigeration up to 4 days, but what happens after 4 days?
Yeah, after 4 days, we believe that you must have at least sunlight, or you probably would have found a grid to connect to.
So it's 4 days without sunlight.
Correct.
Assuming that there's sun every few days, it lasts 365 days a year.
Correct.
Okay, I misunderstood that. I thought it was just like a four-day period, but it can last without the sun for 4 days. Is that right?
Correct.
So where do you envision this going, Ayula?
Yeah, like I mentioned earlier, I mean, Coolbox, to a lot of people, might be just selling products, just selling freezers, but we're a bit more than that. We're actually there to ensure that people, or we believe that people should be able to make money from natural resources. And that's what we're trying to do. And beyond that, we're looking beyond Coolbox. We're looking at ensuring that we're able to convert other refrigerators to solar. And doing so, we believe we'll be able to have access to more people and be able to reduce the problem of food wastage globally. But the global goal of Coolbox at the end of the day is to ensure that we reduce food wastage to the barest minimum across the globe.
The company is Coolbox. That's K-O-O-L-B-O-K-S. Ayula Dominic, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much, Alex, for having me.
Through traffic, anger, and no one can heal it. Shoves a little bump to the momentum. It's just a little lump, but you feel it in the creases and the shadows. With a rattling deep emotion, the cool river sweeps the wild, wide ocean. Yes, boss, the government handshake. The crusher of language, yes, boss. Mr. Stillwater, the face at the edge of the bank with the cool river. Cool river.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author and conservation scientist Tim Killeen. Tim, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Nice to meet you, Alex.
It seems like anybody who studied the Amazon has to be very attuned to the interplay between the indigenous population there, the very fragile ecosystems, and the market forces, the economics that are pushing and pushing constantly this area to the brink. Why don't you give us a little bit of an overview on some of the policies that led us to where we are now? First, let's focus on some of the more deleterious policies, if you can.
The rubber boom at the turn of the 19th, 20th century was really what transformed the Amazon. Before, there was diseases and stuff like this and missionaries and things. But, you know, with the rubber boom, there was this big influx of European and mestizo migrants that went into the region to exploit rubber. There was a second boom during World War II. And so this really seriously negatively impacted the indigenous people. This is, you know, they were already impacted by the great die-off following the Columbian Exchange, but then this, you know, kind of happened all again in the rubber booms. And then what really got things going was in the 1960s and 70s, all of these countries, their governments, many of military governments at this point in time, decided that they had kind of dual issues of over, they were concerned about the population growth and inequality, and there was a big agitation for land reform. And so one of the ways they responded to those threats was to open up the Amazon, build highways into the Amazon, and give land away to everyone who wanted to go down there and knock down the forest and cultivate plants or grow cows or whatever. And so that started in the late 60s, really picked up speed in the 70s, exploded into the 80s, and just it's continued on after on. There's been ups and downs with the rates of migration. There was a massive, you know, millions of people moved into the Amazon in the late 1970s. It kind of dropped off in the 1990s, and now it's kind of an internal growth, lots of internal migration. And starting about 1990, we started having the cultivation of intensive crops like soybeans. So it's a combination of policies, investments in infrastructure. I'm a scientist, so I study nature, but there are other scientists who study crops and cultivation. And so they developed very successful varieties of soybeans and breeds of cows that were well adapted to the region and started generating very significant amounts of cash flow that benefited the people who were moving into the area, benefited the economies of the country. And so things kept going and they got out of hand. And now we have this deforestation crisis, which has been evolving for, you know, at least 35, 40 years. And like I said, ups and downs in the late aughts and the early teens, there was an enormous decrease in deforestation due to policy changes in Brazil. But then, you know, there's been kind of a backlash and things are going in the other direction again. And people were very concerned, me amongst them, I'm very concerned about the fate of the Amazon.
So, Tim, we're talking about the policies that led to the deforestation in the Amazon. What are some of the ones that you cover in the book and that we all should be aware of?
Yeah, no, the most obvious and infamous one was the decision to build highways. And the Brazilian military government in the 1970s, they actually had deliberate policies to build. They said, you know, people without land should live in the land without people, was their view of it. And so they built highways specifically into remote areas and specifically along their frontier areas, like on the border between Bolivia and Brazil, or the border between Brazil and say Venezuela. They specifically created colonies. They called them colonies back then, and encouraged people to move there. First, they encouraged smallholders as a way to relieve some of the social pressures and some of in their more settled areas. But then they realized that it was more profitable, if I can say that, to give away land to large landowners. And so they fostered then an additional policy. And in addition to the one to giving land to poor people, they started giving a land away to corporations and, you know, literally giving it to them. In fact, actually giving them money to develop it. There was an institution called SUDAM in Brazil, and where they provided tax credits and subsidized loans to people who'd go in, and that helped them, you know, build a local road. You know, from first they built the interstate highway system, and then they started building local roads and gave money to people who were willing to cut down the forest and grow cows, basically, both the large and small scale. And similar type things happened in Bolivia and Peru and Colombia. Simultaneously, they were developing their mineral assets. There's parts of Peru that are just have these terrifically rich iron ore deposits. There's other parts with copper reserves, nickel, aluminum. There's very large aluminum deposits situated just, you know, basically in the above, right near the Amazon River, some of the largest aluminum mines in the world are in the Amazon, and bauxite mines, actually. And similar things happen in Peru where they have big copper mines, and those are up in the Andes, but they're part of the Amazon because they're in the Amazon basin. I treat them as being part of the Amazon. That water flows downhill and goes into the Amazon. And certainly culturally, the indigenous people of the highlands are now migrating massively into the lowlands of the Peruvian Amazon, have been doing it for 20 or 30 years. Most of them smallholders, most of them poor people moving from rural areas and where there's a lot of land tension, and there's been very conflict. But there was a civil war in Peru during the 1990s with the Sendero Luminoso. So part of the policy response to that type of social upheaval was, hey, go to the Amazon and we'll give you land. And so these were policies that seemed coherent to their leaders of the time, and they're having the consequences now of this ever-increasing population of farmers and ranchers that are settling along highways or mining. There's also this massive informal gold mining community, and all of the countries, all nine countries, have very large population of what they call wildcat miners. These are smaller operations, still industrialized. I estimate there's about 450,000 people engaged in the small scale mining industry, and that's and generating a lot of money. And so it's a part of this phenomenon. And of course, governments, if you know they don't foster it, they certainly tolerate it, you know, because there's, you know, there's so many of them, and they're well organized, and you know, local unions and stuff. And so it's difficult to say, oh no, we don't want you to do that, because these people are. They vote, and they're also volatile. They're willing to you know, blockade roads and stuff to protect their production systems. So those are, you know, one set of policies, and there's other, you know, like Brazil has this policy to generate electricity through dams. So they built lots of dams in the Amazon, which have their own impact, not on deforestation, but they certainly impede the river system, or the aquatic ecosystems that are dependent upon the river. There's all kinds of migratory fish. You build a dam, you mess with their life cycle. And so that's another group of policies, this time energy, to disrupt, you know, an aquatic ecosystem. They also discovered oil in Texaco, for instance, in the 1950s, discovered oil in Ecuador. And Ecuador is a member of OPEC, and so they've, you know, most of their oil comes from the Amazon. Peru, similar, Colombia, Bolivia, you know, even in Brazil's got this very large natural gas field right in the heart of the Amazon. And they generate money for the state and tax revenues and royalty revenues, but, you know, a lot of toxic chemicals and secondary impacts. Of course, you have, you know, if you have an oil well, you need to have a road to the oil well, so people settle along the road. So just all these things kind of feeding off one on the other, and we end up with the situation where we have an Amazon that's probably about 20% deforested, 18-19% they figure, which doesn't seem a lot, but it's, you know, it's also highly fragmented. If you look at the, you know, the penetration of the roads and the area that's, you know, maybe more like 40% of the Amazon has been impacted by some sort of human activity.
Tim Killeen, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The Clash, T-Bone Walker, and Paul Simon. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show, or subscribe to our podcast on our site, or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.